Thank you so much for joining us this morning, and thank you to Rabbi Winter and Nicole for organizing this amazing program and for inviting me to be a part of it. They always do such incredible work, and sometimes you have the outsider view and sometimes you have the insider view, so it's a pleasure to be here today with you. The whole topic of this Yom Iyun, of this morning, of generation is so important, the sandwich generation, and so many important topics are being discussed here today. It's something I saw very definitively. I haven't reached myself in terms of feeling the challenges of the sandwich generation, but I have seen my parents go through quite acutely, and always saw my parents, when I was growing up, taking care of us, and then as my grandparents became older, taking care of them, and then all of a sudden being caught in between. And there are many instances that I could point to, very particular moments of that conflict coming to a head, but of course also more broadly in the background, always looming, and the stresses of that are definitely big and definitely important to discuss. My topic this morning, although looking at the crowd here, maybe we'll modify a little bit, my topic was more about parenting than about, you know, looking after aging parents, but I think the topic is everyone continues to parent or grandparent or look at other people who are parenting and have advice for them. So I think it's relevant. And I think you'll see, even though the particular angle we'll look at is more of the parenting side, I think that has broader applications as well. The question of how to properly parent, as you all know, is the million-dollar question with absolutely no answer. And there's no answer because it's such a complicated endeavor, and because there is no handbook to parenting, and because the handbook of parenting would need to change on the fly dynamically all the time. So it would be practically impossible to put together such a manual, even if you wanted to. But it's interesting, one of my professors, my teacher, is Dr. David Pelkovitz, who some of you might know, psychologist, teaches at Yeshiva University. He's an expert in child and adolescent development, and also in trauma area in specific. He has a lot of connections here to our community as well, and hopefully will be joining us in the fall at KMS for a scholar in residence. But he has something very interesting in his book called Balanced Parenting. He wrote the book with his father. His father was a shul rabbi for many years, and he was a psychologist, and they wrote a book together called Balanced Parenting, which is a great book to read. So he says here in source number one, an interesting thought. He says, unfortunately, in today's complex world, it's increasingly difficult to know how to raise our children in a manner that maximizes the chances that they will grow up to become truly good, proper, and worthy. Of course, like we said, the million-dollar question. How do you have the magic formula to be able to raise children, especially in the complicated society that we live in? But, he says, really interestingly, there is a surprising degree of agreement among psychologists about what constitute the central ingredients in successfully raising children. You can't find the exact parameters and directions, how to go from A to B to C, but he says if you look out there in the world of psychology, in the world of understanding of children and parenting, there are certain basic principles that stand out as being agreed upon by everybody as the core overarching principles, even if you can't distill it to the particulars of any given day. And he says it's surprising. Surprisingly, for a field in which there is often dissension and conflicting opinions, the findings of these studies are consistent regarding the core characteristics that comprise successful child rearing. Despite vastly different, you know, disagreements in the realm of psychology and parenting, you find, he says, that if you distill everything that everybody is saying, even from opposite ends of the spectrum, they all come down to certain agreed upon core fundamental principles. What he says even more interestingly is that those fundamental agreed upon principles are actually the ones that are reflected in our Masorah, in our tradition, in the Ma'amarei Chazal that we know as well. Right? So if you take away all the modern, you know, jargon and, you know, particulars, if you really distill it to its core, you see that that's exactly what Chazal were trying to tell us as well. And he builds this out of one particular Gemara. If you look on source number two, an interesting Gemara, there's a lot of interesting things on this particular Amud of Gemara, but Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Tana Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, La'olam tie smol doche v'yamin mekareves. Here's a principle, really the Gemara is speaking more about tshuva and how to inspire people to change. But if you think about what motivates people to tshuva or to change, or to parenting, there's actually a lot of commonality in there. It because it's all about directing people and inspiring people and motivating people. So there is something of common value there. So in talking about tshuva, the Gemara says, la'olam, always, the best principle is smol docha v'yamin mekareves, that the left hand should push away and the right hand should bring the person close. So really what, you know, left side is always considered the side of judgment, the side of gvura, and the right side is considered the side of chesed, more loving side. So the right hand should be the one to pull a person close and the left hand should be the one to push away. And really what Chazal were saying is if you're trying to inspire someone to tshuva, you have to do both. You have to play a little bit tough, smol docha, and you have to play it with a little bit of love, of yamin mekarevas. It's actually an incredible vort on this Gemara about Rav Simcha Wasserman. Simcha Wasserman was the son of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, who was killed in the Holocaust. The son came to America before the war, and because of that he escaped. Eventually lived in Detroit, I think, and then California, and made Aliyah, and I think in the 1970s, Rav Simcha Wasserman. So he says on this Gemara, what does it mean, smol docha v'yamin mekarevas? So if you read the pshat, simple reading of this Gemara, it means sometimes you have to play it tough, and sometimes you have to play it with love. You have the combination in the totality of things that'll work well. He says, no, it's actually talking about the very same moment. I'll use this prop here. He says, what happens if simultaneously you push with the right, you pull with the right and push with the left? So you pull with the right and push with the left. What happens? Turn the person around. So if the Gemara is talking about tshuva, about changing a person, right? So it's not that sometimes, you know, you pull and sometimes you push, but together, in the very same moment, you have to find that winning combination of being able to convey the love and convey the toughness. And if you do that, they end up turning the person around. An incredible power of smol docha v'yamin mekareves. But I really think it's not just about tshuva. But Dr. Pelkovitz says you could extrapolate from this Gemara to any relationship, but specifically the relationship of parenting. And what he calls it is the balance, not of smol docha v'yamin mekareves, but the balance of love and limits. To try to simultaneously convey love and limits, the smol docha and the yamin mekareves, is a very difficult thing to do, but it's absolutely the important formula. And he says if you distill all of the contemporary wisdom about child rearing and parenting, that's what it comes down to, being able to achieve that balance of love and limits. And I think today the love piece is much more easily achieved, although not always achieved, okay? But something parents have an easier time with, trying to convey the love. I think the limits are often what parents find very challenging, grandparents find very challenging. I think people in the world in general just find very challenging. Number one, you always are afraid of alienating people, and specifically alienating your kids. If I push too hard, if I'm too strict, what's going to happen? They're going to run the other way. And I think secondly, we live in a society where, you know, the ethic of society around us is all about autonomy. It's all about freedom and lack of encumbrances and lack of authority. And so to try to instill authority and limits and rules and obligations and responsibilities and a little bit of strictness in a context where that's abhorred, where that's anathema, it's a very difficult thing to do, and we're afraid to step into that place. But I think it's critically necessary, as you see from this Gemara about smol docha yamin mekareves. If all you have is the yamin mekareves, it's not powerful enough. You have to have the smol docha simultaneous with the yamin mekareves. You have to have both the love and the limits. What I wanted to do in the remaining time of the shir today is really take a look at how HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to us, and show you that in that relationship, you really find this balance of love and limits. And hopefully we can extrapolate from that relationship that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has with us to the way we need to relate to each other, to our children, to our grandchildren, to those around us, also striking that balance of love and limits, and trying to take a look at why each one of those components is so important to our relationship. So let's start with the kind of paradigmatic principal moment in the relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Bnei Yisrael. And that's, of course, the moment of Matan Torah. If you look at source number 5 on your sheets, Psukim describe the scene of Matan Torah. Vayi bayom ha-shlishi b'yos ha-boker, vayi kolos uvrakim, v'anan kaved al-ahar, v'kol shofar chazak meod, v'yecherad kol ha'am asher b'machane. You see, it's a scary scene. A scene of clouds and thunder and the sound of the shofar, and the reaction of the people is Vayecherad kol ha'am asher b'machaneh. The people are shaking, the people are trembling. So there's an aura of fear. Vayotze Moshe es ha'am likras elokim min ha'machane. Moshe brings the people out from the camp towards God. Vayisyatzvu betachtis ha'har. And they find themselves standing underneath the mountain. So the plain shot of the pasuk, of course, they're standing at the foot of the mountain, under the mountain, meaning under the shadow of the mountain. Vayisyatzvu betachtis ha'har. But very famously, as I'm sure many of you have heard, this Gemara interprets these words a little bit differently to try to paint the scene of what was being achieved here in this moment of Matan Torah. If you look at source number 6, very famous Gemara in Shabbos, pertinent, oftentimes mentioned on Shavuos time, but also pertinent to Purim, which is coming up. The pasuk says, "Vayisyatzvu betachti sahar." The Gemara darshins this pasuk as follows. Amar of Avdimi Barchama Barchasa. Avdimi Barchama Barchasa says the following is the correct interpretation of the Jewish people standing underneath the mountain. Not at the foot of the mountain, but Melamed Shekafa Kadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem Esahar Kigigis. What we learn from the fact the Jewish people were standing underneath the mountain is that they were literally standing underneath the mountain. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu picked up the mountain of Har Sinai and held it over their heads like a gigis, like a barrel. And Hashem said to them in that moment, Amar Lahem, Imatem Mekablim HaTorah Mutav. If you accept the Torah, wonderful. Everything will be fine. V'im Lav, Sham Tehei Kvuraschem. And if you don't accept the Torah, then here will be your burial place. Meaning? He will drop the mountain. So how many of you have heard of this Gemara? Okay, very famous Gemara. So what's the meaning of this Gemara? What's Rav Dima Bar Chama Bar Chasa trying to convey here about the nature of the scene of Matan Torah? Simply put, one or two phrases.
One choice.
One choice or? No choice. Right? So the whole scene of Matan Torah, the beginnings of that relationship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Israel, happened in the context of no choice, or what others call coercion. The Jewish people were coerced into accepting the Torah. And so, of course, Chazal were very wary of this concept. As you know, any contract that's taken under duress is seriously flawed, perhaps not a contract at all. So Amar of Achabar Yaakov says, Mikan Muda Rabba Lo Raisa. You have a great claim against the nature of the Torah. How could the Torah be binding on the Jewish people if it was accepted under duress? So Rava comes with an answer, Amar Rava Afa Pichain. Yeah, it was accepted under duress. Yeah, the implication of Rava is maybe it wasn't binding. But don't worry. Afa Pichain, Hadar Kiblu Abi Meachashverosh. By the time of the Purim story, which happens a long, long, long time, thousands of years later, by the time of the Purim story, they re-accepted the Torah, not out of coercion, but willingly. How do you know that? Dichsiv, because it says, Pasuk in Megillas Esther, Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim, talking about the celebration of Purim. It says, Kimu v'kiblu, that they established, Kimu v'kiblu, and they accepted ha-Yehudim. The Jewish people of that time accepted the holiday of Purim. That's the pshat of the Pasuk. But the way Rav is darshaning, Kimu mashikiblu kvar. What did they establish at that time? What were they mekayim? They established that which they had already received. They already received the Torah out of coercion. And now in the time of Purim, they were so inspired by the relationship with Hashem. He had saved them in this great time of great danger. So they decide, you know what? Let's accept the Torah willingly, as opposed to the coercive Torah that we accepted all this time. Very, very strange Gemara. There's a lot of questions on this Gemara. We'll start to raise some of those questions. But just on a very simple level, what I think is trying to be conveyed here by Rav Dima Bar Chama Bar Chasa is the Torah, or the relationship between God and the Jewish people, is one of, would you say, love or limits?
Limits.
Okay, coercion is a hard, harsh word. Kafalim hakagi is a hyperbolic statement. But really what's being conveyed here is that the Torah is a serious thing. That there's limits and responsibilities and obligations. There's a hierarchy in the relationship between God and Jewish people. God's up here holding a mountain. We're down here with lack of choice. Just like if you would imagine in a parenting relationship. Parent says, no, you do this. You don't have a choice. So God is saying to us, limits, obligations, authority, responsibility. That seems to be the picture that's being conveyed. But there's actually a very different picture that's conveyed by other Mamrei Chazal. This is one strand of thinking in Chazal. But if you look at source number 7, see a very different perception. The Mechilta quotes a pasuk, Vayomer Hashem Misinai Ba, part of the Brachos, the Torah, says Hashem Misinai Ba. Hashem comes from Sinai. So, Medrash says, Al Tikra Kein. Ela Hashem l'Sinai ba. Shouldn't say Hashem was coming from Sinai. It should say Hashem came to Har Sinai. Litan Torah Lisra, right? They met at Har Sinai. Jewish people came. God came. God gave them the Torah. So it should say Hashem l'Sinai ba. But it doesn't. It says Hashem mi Sinai ba. O'eno Omer Kein, Ela Hashem mi Sinai ba. Maybe it's purposeful. Maybe really it should be Hashem mi Sinai ba to teach us Lekabel es Yisrael kechasan zeshu yotze likras kala. When the Jewish people were coming at Har Sinai, it's not like they were coming from here. God was coming l'Sinai from here, but we were coming to Sinai, and God was coming from Har Sinai, like a chasan goes out to greet the kala. And this is where the wedding imagery of Har Sinai comes into play, as the chasan and kala meet each other, and as you see at some chasanas, that instead of waiting under the chuppah, the chasan comes down. And the Kala and Chasan walk together to the Chuppah, so that's taken from this imagery of this Medrash. The Chasan, Ayotze Likras Kala, Chasan goes out to greet the Kala, and together they come under the Chuppah here being Har Sinai. So if you take this Medrash at face value, what's the image or the emotion or the scene of Matan Torah? Love or limits?
Love.
Totally different strand over here. Furthermore, the same medrash darshins our pasuk vayisyatzvu betachtis lahar. They were standing under the mount. Look at the next paragraph. Vayisyatzvu nitzfufu. They were standing crowded under the mountain. What does that mean? Melamed shenitlash hahar mimakomo. We learn that the mountain was removed from its place. Okay, without looking at the rest of the medrash, what would you say comes next? Mountain was nitlash mimakomo, and they were standing underneath. Meaning what? Why? Because God was about to threaten them and say, if you don't accept the Torah, I'm going to drop the mountain. But it doesn't say that. V'karvu v'amdu tachasahar. Shenemar v'tikravun v'tamdun tachasahar. Medrash says, no, got it all wrong. Why did God pick up the mountain and hold it over their heads? And what does it mean to say that they were standing under the mountain, gathered on the mountain? It means they were so afraid of the kolos of Rakim, the sounds and the lightning and the thunder and the cloud, they were afraid. And so God picks up the mountain, they all come out under the mountain to protect themselves for safety. If God shields them in the canopy of his mountain to protect them and to support them and to nurture them and say there's nothing to be afraid of, just like we hold people, you know, in our arms, God was literally holding them under the protection. So you have two different images here, the chuppah image of chasan and kala, and the protective image, perhaps like a parent protects their child, both being conveyed by this medrash. And other midrashim seem to support the same view. What I want to show you here is that we commonly know the Gemara in Shabbos, that the scene of Matan Torah is one of coercion. But if you look at all these Mamrei Chazal, you see actually it's both. It's a moment of great love and great limits. And I don't think these two strands of Chazal are mutually exclusive at all. They're not contradictory images. What I think is being conveyed to us by the totality of these Mamrei Chazal is that the scene of Matan Torah had to be both. It had to be a scene of love and of limits, because that's the nature of our relationship with our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and both were critically important. And actually, this fits so well with the Pshat of the Psukim. You know, we get lost sometimes in all the Midrashim and Mamrei Chazal. Look at the Pshat of the Psukim. There is an awe and fear and limits perspective in the Psukim. You see the fear of the people, Vayecherad Ha'am, they're shaking because of the sounds and the lightning. But you also see the Psukim of Nasev and Ishma. The Jewish people say, we will nasa, do, and nishma. We will accept, we will listen. They willingly accept the Torah. So how do you fuse those two together? Maybe they're not contradictory at all. Maybe they're both teaching us the story of the totality of the picture of Matan Torah. The Ramban, look at page 2. The Ramban seems to support this view, source number 13. This is the Ramban in Shas, the Ramban on that Gemara in Shabbos of Kafaleim Harkigigis. He asks a great question. What's one of the questions you would ask on that coercion Gemara? So the question of the Gemara is, if it's coerced, how is it binding upon Jewish people? And Rava says, don't worry, in the time of Purim, they re-accepted it. So what would be your question? What happened until then? Elaborate. Who cares? So let's say it wasn't obligatory during that time. So what? Good. What happened between Matan Torah and the Purim story? Give me a few major incidents of Jewish... Okay, Egal Zav, what else? the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. So the exile of the Jewish people, cycles of punishment in times of the Shoftim. So Jewish people obviously were held responsible for the Torah all of that time. So Rava's answer is only partially satisfactory, because you have to assume somehow that it was binding during that time. Otherwise, how were they ever punished or held responsible for their deeds? It's a great question that the Ramban asks. So what does the Ramban say? Very simple answer. Yes, in that moment, maybe they were coerced in a certain way. Kafalem har kegiyis. But in the very next moment, they said, not out of coercion, but out of desire to love and to follow HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his ways. So why was it binding upon them? Because they willingly accepted it. Not in the time of Purim, but in that moment, they willingly accepted it. So what does it mean when in the time of Purim they re-accepted it? So the Ramban has an explanation of what it meant and what exactly was the added level of Kabbalah that happened in the time of Purim. But the Ramban says essentially in that moment both were present. The loving acceptance of the Torah in that relationship, and the limits perspective of authority. So both were coming together in that critical moment. So I think that's the picture we get of what our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is supposed to be like. So why are each of these elements important in a relationship? Why are the love and the limits, any relationship, in a spousal relationship, in a friend relationship, relationship with Hashem, parents and children, why is love important? What does love do for a relationship? Okay, it adds a level of sweetness to the difficult time. We'll come back to that point.
It's fine. You can say the two things that are a balance.
Okay. Before we get to the balance, why are each of them important? Why is love important? Bonding, the glue, compassion, okay. Acceptance, trust, right? So support. Beautiful. Sees you through the hard times. So what does love create? I think love creates a certain sense of security. Let's say just talking about the parenting relationship. Love creates a sense of support, like that image of Har Sinai protecting them, right? That love is about instilling in a child the fact that they are supported and they're loved unconditionally, which gives them the strong backing and foundation to go out and develop their own sense of self, to go out and make their own mistakes. A person can only feel comfortable to make mistakes when they know that they're going to be accepted no matter what. And if they have that context of love, of support, that foundation that exists of love, then I think that children can go and explore. And if children can't go and explore, then they can't achieve the same level of successes. There's an amazing pasuk. Look at source number 14. Pasuk in Tehillim. It says, "Kechitzim biyad gibor, ken bnei hanu'urim." Like the arrow in the hand of an archer, so too are the bnei hanu'urim, the children. What does that mean? Why is the children's success compared to the archer's success?
When you aim the arrow, it goes where you want it to go.
Okay, so aiming, focus, direction, that's good. Yeah?
Skill.
It takes skill to raise children. Okay, perhaps.
Travels from the source,
okay. I like that. To a new place, right? You give them that nurturing, bonding, loving place, and then they can exit to new horizons, new vistas. That's true. The Kotzker Rebbe has a beautiful word on this pasuk. He says, what happens when an archer is trying to shoot an arrow far, right? So they have to pull strong, it takes a lot of force, and they pull and pull and pull and pull, and they pull it so close to till they're at their body, and then they release it. And the stronger they pull it into their body, right? If they just went like this, it wouldn't go so far. Pull all the way into their body, that's when the arrow goes far. The Kotzker Rebbe says that's what's the comparison between the archer and parenting. Ken b'nei hana'urim means the closer you pull your children in to love them, closer you pull them into you, the farther they're going to go. That if you are trying to get your children to go far places, the first instinct you have to do is to pull them close. The stronger the loving background that they have, the farther they'll be able to soar on their own. It's an amazing image and comparison between these two different realms. So love is clearly important, and we all understand that. But why are limits important? That's really what I want to get to the rest
limits
of this time.
Convey love.
Limits convey love. What do you mean?
When you tell your child, we don't do that, or that's not something you do, or this is how you need to do it, you're telling your child that you care enough to help them.
Beautiful.
Children learn love from that.
Okay, amazing. I'll skip around because what you said is so beautiful. Take a look at the next page for a second. This is an image that I love to show. I've done parts of this year with a lot of high school kids and middle schoolers. I love conveying this. See these two pictures here on page 3? It's terrifying. Okay, so there's on the right-hand side a guy on a cliff looking over, and the left-hand side a guy on a cliff looking over, right? So I ask the kids often, it's a great exercise. So I ask them, their kids are interested in autonomy and freedom, and they don't want to be limited and shackled. And I ask them, so who's freer over here? What's the difference between these two people? One has a harness and one doesn't. So who's freer here?
The guy with the harness.
So they always say the guy on the right. He could do what he wants. He could jump off. He could stay on. But the truth is, the guy with the harness is much more free than the guy without. Yes. And children don't understand that yet.
Safer, too.
Safer. But there's actually a different image. There's a Christian theologian, G.K. Chesterton, 19th century, was trying to answer the criticisms against religion in general. So, Lahavdil, Elif Alfei Avdalos, to bring in from a Christian theologian. But he has a great image, which I love to convey. He says, imagine people are playing basketball. He doesn't say basketball. He's a sport. Play basketball on the cliff of a very steep, steep mountain. Okay? So every time they're shooting the ball, they're afraid the ball is going to go over the side. Or they're afraid they're going to fall over the side of the mountain. But if you put a fence around the top of that mountain, all of a sudden they can play the game freely. They don't have to be worried about where they're going to trip, where they're going to fall, where they're going to go, where the ball is going to go. So ironically, putting the fence around them, which seems to be limiting and constricting, is actually the thing that makes them the most free. Free to play within that box, to play within that context. And I think that's what the difference between these two images is. The guy with the harness can feel safe to climb and to grab and to jump and to maximize his potential, whereas the guy with the briefcase is afraid of every step he's going to take. That sometimes the limits can actually be the most freeing thing. In the context of parenting, limits can actually help children to grow, both because it allows them the freedom within the box to explore, knowing that there's a box, and knowing what the expectations are. And it also conveys a certain measure of love, because if there is no box, then children think that perhaps the parents don't care. So it conveys love, but it also allows them to be more free. Actually, so many studies show that children in the classroom, this is where most of the studies take place, but and outside the classroom as well, they really appreciate and thrive on the limits. When they know exactly what's expected of them, actually studies show that motivation increases 1,000-fold. Right? So you would think that the more limits they're placed upon, I'm not going to be motivated, they're limiting me, and I have to do it this way, and I have to do it that way. But no, it's actually the opposite. Motivation increases the more that kids have limits and expectations. So that box is, I think, very important. And that's what's conveyed by the limits in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. People would claim that religion shackles us and that religion is, so constricting. But no, actually, religion, which is filled with obligations and limits, is very freeing. And it does convey a certain sense of love in the relationship. And I think the same is true in context.
The word limit, and my mind is bouncing off of the word direction. Uh-huh. Limit means to only have this direction within the limit.
Right.
Is actually the good thing. Maybe it's the word. Maybe limit sounds negative,
but
direction is a little more.
Direction, I don't know if they're the same. I hear what you're saying. They're not the same, right? Because direction means I can direct you, and then you can go wherever you want, like on that path. Limits are saying, no, you can't. So what really is, and maybe what this is what you're saying, but it's actually like if you carved out a path where the boundaries are very clear, and now the direction is clear, and then now you say go. That's really what's being conveyed by limits. Not blocking them, but guiding them. I guess that's what you're saying. I think that's very true. So I think that one of the important pieces of limits is, of course, to convey that level of love and obligation, and that it can actually be more freeing. The other piece that I think is important, Rabbi Soloveitchik stresses this when he discusses why coercion was so important in the context of Matan Torah and our relationship with Hashem, is because you have to understand that there's a hierarchy. Imagine the people at Matan Torah. You've just been spoken to directly by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That could cause a person to feel, quite boastful. Wow, I'm on the level of God. Yeah, we had a conversation. But that fear, that awe, that trepidation of Har Sinai, the kafal in Har Kigigis, was meant as the balance. That yes, you're incredible human beings, and you're on the level where I could reveal myself to you directly, but you have to know that there's a hierarchy here. That at some level you have to recoil and say, yes, there's a God that's above me, not equal to me, but above me. And that level of humility, to be able to recognize there's something greater than myself, is part of what limits and authority and coercion instills in that relationship with Hashem. The same is true of parenting. When there's limits in the context of parenting, not only does it convey love, but it does convey the opposite as well. It conveys a hierarchy. I'm the one setting the tone, and you're the one listening to that tone. And that's so important because children need to have direction. And if they think that parents are equals, and they think the parents are on their level, which sometimes they have to be, but if that's the only context of the relationship, then why should I take my guidance from a parent or anybody above me? So to develop within a child that level of humility, to understand that there are those who are above them, who have what to offer, who have what direction to give, I think is very important. That's another point. A further point Maharal makes, I think this is a commonly understood idea, but if you think about, forget parenting relationships for a second, but just the context perhaps of marriage or other relationships, there's something very nice and comforting about the love, but there's also something very comforting about obligation. And Maharal makes this point about Gadol Mitzuvah Ve'osa, Mishayin Mitzuvah Ve'osa. The greater is the one who's commanded than the one who's not commanded. Why is commandedness important in the relationship with Hashem? Because, you know, if you decide of your own volition, one moment, to do something nice for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so in that moment, that's huge. You weren't even obligated to do that. You went out of your way. That's amazing. That's tremendous. But it's here one moment and gone the next. The next moment, you could feel, I'm not into it. Forget it. But if you do something out of obligation, then actually what you're conveying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, you know, whether I like it or I don't like it, I'm in this for the long haul. And if one minute I do feel it and one minute I don't care, it doesn't matter. I'm in this for the long haul. And what that breeds is a level of trust. Trust in a relationship. So in the spousal relationship, you know, it's like kind of cliche example, but right? So one spouse buys the other spouse a present, surprise gift, and they're so excited in that moment. So what's greater? That surprise flowers or chocolates, whatever it is, or a trip somewhere, or the taking out the trash and doing the laundry and, you know, those obligatory kind of pieces. So in the moment, the surprise gift feels really, really good. But in the long haul, to know that you have someone who has your back, who is always going to fulfill their obligations and be there to support you in the way that you need, in the long run, builds a lot more trust and a lot more stability in a relationship than those one-time gifts. So I think the same thing is true with our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what the Maharal says over here. The idea of tzivui, of limits, that coercion, that har kigigis piece is meant to convey that to build a relationship with Hashem, you have to have obligations. Obligations of Hashem to us and obligations of us to Hashem. It's the nature of tzivui, of mitzvah. I think in the level, in the context of parenting, that's equally important. The same idea of limits is important to build that solid trust in a relationship. Children should know, my parents are always going to do this for me. And I don't have to question that. I don't have to wonder about that. Yeah, sometimes they're going to surprise me and take me out for ice cream. But I know every morning they're going to be there to feed me and they're going to be there to take me to school and build that level of consistency and trust from the parent to the child. And then from the child having obligations to the parent or to the values of the parents also allows them to feel, you know, that my parent knows they can count on me. And that level of trust that's built through obligation is very different than through love and spontaneity.
You mentioned about the obligation at Har Sinai.
Yes.
But we had just undergone its time here at Siyamsev.
Right. Beautiful. Beautiful, right, that's very true. Actually, if you look at the whole picture of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, and then the Midbar, you do have like different times where some of the elements are more present than the others. Some obligation, some, you know, gifts, some love and limits. But right, if you take the whole picture together, you do find that balance. There's so much more to convey here, but I wanted to just, I guess, end with one more piece. I think it's fascinating. It's so important in terms of our relationship with Hashem, but also in terms of parenting. If you go to page 4, it's the page with all the Hebrew on it. Page 4. It doesn't have a number at the bottom. It's after the picture. Right after the picture. I brought a little piece here from this book. I love this book. Called Da Ma Shetashiv La'atzmacha. know what you should answer to yourself. It's about questions of faith and other important questions in Judaism. So he makes an incredible point. He starts this essay with the question that we started with, which people struggle with in our modern society today. People say in society there's a value to autonomy and freedom and self and whatever I like to do, right? And so they're against religion because religion is very limiting. So how could we say, Ein lecha ben chorin ela misha osek b'talmud Torah, that we believe Torah is what frees us, when Torah is really what shackles us? So he goes into all essay explaining it. That's the context of this essay. But he says something fascinating here, which I don't think people think about enough. You look here, it says, Kedei Lahavin. It's like the last paragraph on the right-hand side, second to last paragraph. If you don't have it or you can't follow, just listen. I'll explain it as we go. Kedei Lahavin mihu ben chorin, umahu akesher shebein adam Yisrael l'torah l'mitzvoseha, yesh lizkor shehachayim nichpu aleinu. You want to understand the nature of mitzvos and obligations that shackle us, so to speak, and what it means to be free. Start with one clear point, and that is that life itself was thrust upon us without our choice. Me'olam lo nishal adam im birtzono lehivaled. No person was ever asked if they wanted to be born. Heichan ule'ela horim, where they wanted to be born, who they wanted to be born to. Zohi uvda, that's just a fact, you can't deny that. Birth happens without anybody's consent. Ein perish hadavar shekfiya zohi shlilit. That's not to say that that's a bad thing, that's a negative thing. It's a fact. It's an uvda. Elozehu uvda. Noladnu. We were born. Beinim anu rotzim bekach, beinim lo. Whether we wanted to or not. Im nisponen hetev, navchin. If you look further, we're also discerned. Shekashim sheachayim nichpu aleinu. Just as life was thrust upon us, kam kach gam chukehem. So too the laws of life were thrust upon us without our choice. Hein chukei achayim agufaniim, the physical form laws of life. Hein chukei achayim aruchniim, so too the spiritual laws. Beguf, in terms of the physical. Adam nolad im evarim misuyayim. Not only was life thrust upon you, but the organs you were given in your body were given to you without your choice. Yadayim, raglayim, klayos, lev, kledam, moach, ve'od, all the organs were given to us without any choice. Ha'adam chayav lisnaga pi chukei achayim shebi varim elu. And you have to abide by the laws of nature in order to sustain those limbs which were given to you. Kedei sheyarich yamim, so that you could have long life. Hu chayav lishtos, nose limb. You have to drink things that are liquid. Sheim lokein yamus. If you don't drink, you're going to die. Kmo keinu chayav lahachil mazon vitaminim misuyamim. You have to eat certain vitamins in order to be able to survive. Shim lo kein, yechdulu marachus gufa letafkid karoi. Your body's going to stop working and functioning correctly if you don't abide by those laws, those limits that were thrust upon you with no choice. Person can't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to live the rest of my life without, I don't know, vitamin C, whatever the case is. They're going to die. They don't have that choice. That is obligatory, thrust upon it. Kachu hadavar gam bebalei chayim, ela shehevdel bein chabalei chayim, levnei adam, shula adam, yesh bechir chav, etc. Okay. Umahu bechiraso. So what is a person's choice? If life was thrust upon us, we have no choice in the matter, what's our choice? Bechiraso hi, haim lihisnaheg al piateva shekayim bo olo. The question is, do you want to follow the laws that will keep you alive or not follow the laws that keep you alive? Essentially what it goes on to say is there's a box. There's a box that's around us that's obligatory that we had absolutely no choice in. Coercion, authority, obligation, responsibility, limits. That's part of life. You were born into that. You could now question, okay, why do you have a Torah and limits and laws? But at a certain basic level, after you go back and back and back, you have to get to a point where you can't deny the fact that rules and laws and limits exist as part of just living as a human being. So he says the key to life is to say there is a box. And I'm obligated to eat and to drink and to sleep, but my choice as a human being and how to grow as a human being lies about how I act within that box. Once you accept that the box exists, how you exist within the box is what creates your freedom. That's just basic human nature, the physics of life, the biology of life. So now when you apply that to religion, same thing exists. You accept the fact that just like in the physical world there is a box, in the spiritual world, there's a box too. And Hashem sets those limits and those parameters for all the positive reasons that we laid out before. And our free choice is how to act within that box. How to become the total self that we are within the box of those limits. I think the same thing is true of parenting, right? You try to convey the limits, right? The love is what's the supportive nature, loving environment that gives your child the confidence to go forward. The limits is what, you know, the boxes that you set around them to convey the love and to convey the expectations and the direction, everything we spoke about. And what you try to instill in the child is the ability within that box to soar. Because without that box, they can't soar. They can't achieve the things that they're supposed to achieve. So it's an impossible task. But if you have a tiny, tiny answer to the million-dollar question, a hint of an answer, what Dr. Pelkovitz is suggesting is that what we should focus on is this balance of love and limits. Just like when Hashem nurtures his relationship with us, he conveys both. The love and the limits are critically important. So too in a parenting relationship, or a grandparenting relationship, or in any relationship, really, in the context of life. To be able to achieve the balance between both sets us up for success and the others for success so that people can reach their true potential and the relationship can reach its true potential, hopefully knowing when to pull out the love and when to pull out the limits, and sometimes to combine them at the same time so that small dochen yimim mekareves actually has the effect of turning the person around. That's the effect that we can have on other people. Thank you so much.